Testing, 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 testing. Is it jumping up and down? Okay. All right. Well, it's kind of a nasty evening out, so appreciate everybody coming out tonight. Before we get underway, are there any announcements or anything that you would like to make the assembly aware of before we get started? Yeah. Yes. Okay. She's thankful for you.
Does that provide chocolate?
Yeah. a little bit of relief. Okay. How's your dad doing, Mark?
Last I spoke with him, he was doing better. He trembling, had a little bit of trembling, but nothing like he had been having. In fact, he said the other day that it's the best day he'd had in over a year. So.
Wow. So, good.
Change the medication. Excuse me. They can go off with it if they need to. So. Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. Well, I think we all know where we are in our studies, so let's get ourselves underway this evening. Now, please, would you open your Bibles to Proverbs chapter 2? Proverbs chapter 2. We're going to pick up where we left off on Sunday, dealing with returning here to get some understanding of the mechanics of the policy of evil as we take a look at the evil man and the strange woman with some advanced understanding, hopefully. And we've got a lot of things to cover, so it's going to be kind of interesting how we do this tonight. Let's begin looking here at verse 10. Once again, it says, "When wisdom entereth into thine heart, and knowledge is pleasant unto thy soul, discretion shall preserve thee, and understanding shall keep thee, to deliver thee from the way of the evil man, from the man that speaketh froward things, who leave the paths of uprightness to walk in the ways of darkness, who rejoice to do evil and delight in the frowardness of the wicked, whose ways are crooked, and they froward in their paths, to deliver thee from the strange woman, even from the stranger which flattereth with her words, which forsaketh the guide of her youth and forgetteth the covenant of her God. For her house inclineth unto death, and her paths unto the dead. None that go in unto her return again, neither take they hold of the paths of life." And we'll stop right there. Before we get ourselves underway this evening, Chris, would you lead us in prayer, please? Before we do get started, I've got some things I want to hand out. And if you want them, fine. If not, that's fine, too. Cecil asked about this. And what I've got is Proverbs 2 and verses 10, 11, and 12. Especially verse 11. And you remember back when we had the definitions on the board of discretion and understanding and how and of preserve and of keeping. Well, what I've done is I've put that all on one little piece of paper so that you've got the verse in bold, and then you've got the explanation, and it's kind of as a ready reference to be able to remind yourself. And what I've put on this are what I would call our working definitions, which it's one thing to just define words out of the OED or something like that, or Webster's, but it's something entirely different to really understand the definition in light of the context in which it sits. And so these are the working definitions for a son. And when wisdom entereth into thine heart, and knowledge is pleasant in thy soul, and then I have discretion, and I give what I had on the board here, shall preserve, and then I give what I had on preserve, the understanding, you get that, shall keep, and you get that, to deliver thee away from the way of the evil man, from the man that speaketh froward things. So if you want to hand those out and take one yourself, was that kind of what you were after?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Well, Cecil's doing that. What we're involved in here is, I think, going to be something rather interesting. Even though we know about the evil man and the strange woman, and we've talked about them numerous times, we've got to be able to come along and advance our understanding of these things, because a son, when he comes to the point of Romans chapter 13 and verses 12 and 13 and is going to enter into a battle, he needs to know with precision, and not in some vague way, but with precision, what he's up against and how this thing is going to work, and be able to identify the policy of evil and the evil man and the strange woman over against just the average, common, ordinary, run-of-the-mill, so to speak, darkness and wickedness and sinfulness and problems that are associated with the course of this world. And that's one of the things that we need to see, and I hope we've covered that enough to be able to say, okay, within that scope there is this other thing going on. And this other thing going on is where the adversary and his policy of evil really concentrates its effort to put out light. And since he is the ruler of darkness, he traffics in darkness, the darkness of untruth. He's going to be able to detect that light. And there's a lot of things, folks, I don't know how deeply involved we're going to get in this, but first of all, I don't know everything I'd like to know. So there is that. I have an awful lot of work to do. But I've come to understand some things better than I ever did before. And I know that we're going to have sufficient enough information to be able to move on and to be able to really finish off the book of Romans when we meet some particular individuals in chapter 16, when the next kind of aspect of the policy of evil is going to get brought up and we're going to have to deal with that. But I want you to also let me know what kind of concerns you have. And I'm not sure that it would be right to ask about them right now, because I know you may have some, but we need to kind of get all of this said and taught so that we'll see if that takes care of some of the problems or some of the, like I say, the concerns that you have. But what we're after is that a son by this point should be able to come to the realization that this policy of evil that the adversary has some particular individuals involved in it that I'm going to be running up against, and that are going to have a concerted effort to try to shut down the light that I am shedding, the armor of light that I have on, as I am intelligently knowing what I'm doing when I'm casting off the works of darkness. And again, one of those things, as we begin to once again look at this profile of the evil man, one of the things that you've got to realize is, and I'm I harp on this, and I say this many, many times, so it's not a lot of new stuff here. But one of the things you've got to recognize is the fact that in order to intelligently do this, you really do need to have the operation of what's gone before. The only reason, and it's right here in Proverbs 2 as well, for a member of the remnant of Israel as a son, the only reason that you're going to be preserved and kept, the only reason, in this context, understand that, it's in this context, the keeping and the preserving here is not God coming along and keeping you physically alive, or keeping your income going, or something along those lines. We're talking about your functional life. Between the being functionally alive and really functioning properly as a son in your sanctified position in Christ, the only way that you're going to meet this adversary's men, and by the way, you will never, I mean this, none of you will ever deal one-on-one with the adversary. You just won't. He hasn't designed his policy of evil to deal with you personally. There's really only one or two people in all of human history that he did that with, Jesus Christ being one of them. But what I'm after is he doesn't have to be able to derail your sonship life and separate you from the love of Christ by personally dealing with you. He has set this up. It's been set up for millennia now, and it's been very effective. Try not to use the word effectual for him, but it's very effective to accomplish his aims, goals, and objectives. But as anybody who would cursory reading to this, you can't with any kind of honesty come up to this thing and say, well, this preservation, this preserving, and this keeping, and this deliverance from the evil man is for me when you don't have discretion, the kind of discretion this is talking about, and you don't have the kind of understanding this is talking about. If that's not there, you're kidding yourself. You're fooling yourself. So that's why it's very critical for us to appreciate, and I'm bringing this out again to say this. This is just a quick representation of what needs to be obtained by a son by the time he gets to Romans 13:13, when he's going to walk honestly as in the day. By the way, we're not quite ready to walk honestly as in the day just yet. There's a couple of things that we got to do, but we're almost there. There's your wisdom. There's your justice. There's the five core features of godly love and charity. Here's the judgment that we're getting now. And one of the big things that comes out of this, and I mentioned it last time, the last couple of Bible classes, discretion comes from that. And the ability that the discretion, and that discretion comes from some things that have been put into motion from that wisdom back there. When we come to chapter 14, we begin dealing with equity and we start dealing with the weaker brother. That's not the first time you and I have ever been talked about by our Heavenly Father about something where you've got estate differences. That's already been broached. And with that, you can you start utilizing some godly generated discretion and some godly generated understanding of how this works. The whole idea of now understanding body thinking and what a body can do, at least to the degree we need to know it. And when that justice came along and gave the additional abilities for us to be able to deal with men at large and with government and with authority and how we live in this world and these kinds of things. The reason I'm putting this on the board and saying something about it tonight, do not underestimate the power that has to generate discretion and understanding. That is a hugely powerful thing. And you're supposed to have that now. And actually begin exercising that. But when it comes to the point of us now engaging in battle, and our Father giving us very pared down, short pockets of information in godly judgment, where this entire education or this entire instruction in initial godly judgment really covers only, 9 verses, from verse 8 through verse 11 or through verse 14 of Romans chapter 13, that godly judgment is given to you in a very brief way. You say, but we've spent years on it. I know. But when your father does that, the expectation is that you're to go back and make some connections. So when you get to the point, pardon my drawing, but when you get to the point, I always do that. You have to turn the pen on first, and then you go to the whiteboard. When you come to the point, and this is you or me, a lot lighter, where you are now going to enter into battle. We'll just put a line here where you're going to cross this line and you're going to begin to deal with the policy of evil in earnest. There are actually 3 areas that you are bringing with you. One of those areas is, we'll put a C in there, that's the curriculum that you've just gone over. And that's what I illustrated just on the board. Everything from Romans 12:3 all the way through Romans 13:12, that's supposed to be effectually working in your inner man. But in order for you to really understand and appreciate what this battle is going to be like and what this adversary has out here for you, and what you're going to face from that adversary, and knowing more than just it's a policy of evil, and it wants to oppose me, and it wants to shut my light down. Well, how does it do that? Well, there's this evil man and this strange woman that's going to do it. Do you really think, is that satisfactory? It's not to me. Not if I'm going to go into battle. You know, that's about like a drill sergeant telling you when you went through boot camp, well, there's bad guys out there and you're going to have to shoot them. Well, what do they look like? And what are they going to be shooting at me? And how am I going to be able to tell? How do I tell how do I tell the bad guys from the good guys? And how do I know what they're trying to utilize against me and what I have available to utilize against them? There's an awful lot here. If life and death is on the line here, and it is, your spiritual functional life and death is on the line. Because this character, whether or not you know it, he knows that he's going to attempt to separate you from the love of Christ, which is your sonship life, and the love that you have that matches Christ's love for it. So this guy knows exactly what he's doing. So one of the things that you're going to have in order to be able to clearly understand what's going on is that curriculum as it's been taught to this point. Because you're not going to meet the adversary who is going to throw everything he can possibly throw in his arsenal at you. As a matter of fact, let me tell you very bluntly, the very first skirmishes you're going to have with the adversary are going to seem like a piece of cake. They're going to be relatively, for most of you in here, they're going to be relatively easy. And that's by design too. Because that joker, he went through, you ever heard of a sophomore jinx? You don't know what a sophomore jinx is? Well, when I was pitching horseshoes and I won my first tournament in my class, not like I won the world championship, but I won my first tournament in my class, then I got kind of spooked by it all, thinking, was that just a fluke or could I do it again? That was kind of my freshman. Well, the sophomore jinx is when you go to do it again, you know, can you still do, you know, you've surely heard of sophomore, all you sports people, you've heard of sophomore jinx. Well, the adversary got messed up with that, and he learned from it. And one of the things he delights in is giving you your first go-around where you feel like, oh, that was nothing. I'll wait for the next one. But anyway, we'll explain some of that a little later. The other thing that you're bringing with you is your ability to know what's going on out there, not only from the curriculum that your father taught you, but there is something back there in, I'm going to put R8, what do you think that stands for? Romans 8. There's something that has been told to you in Romans 8 that you're going to go back to, and you're going to go back to Romans 8 again and again and again and again, and you're going to find out that even though we may have done an adequate job of teaching it, every single thing that you'll ever face in your Christian life, even as far out as you can possibly get into level 2, level 3, whatever it is, as far as you go in your spiritual life and your godly edification, the foundation for everything that you will experience, good, bad, and indifferent, is found in Romans 8. And especially in Romans 8, verses 14 through 39. And most of the time in Romans 8, verses 31 through 39. Those five probing questions. So there's something that's sitting back there in Romans 8 that was told to us that's a tip-off as to what's going to be taking place in this battle. And the other thing that you're going to have with you as well are these exhortations that's sitting back here in the book of Proverbs. Well, that's a crude way of illustrating that, but what I'm after is that when it comes to, let's do this. Let's put, when it comes to thinking about engaging the evil man, engaging into the policy of evil now, where you're going to perform a gesture, you're going to put on some armor of light, and you're going to be an easy target for the adversary because there's no camouflage. And a son should know before he ever does that. He should know what to expect, how it's going to occur, how it's different from just any other trouble or tribulation that he might have in life. And there's all kinds of brands of tribulation. And one of the things that alerts him to exactly how this is going to take place is really what we find back there in Romans chapter 8, and especially verse 35. Now, we don't need to turn to that, but what you actually have there is kind of like to use terminology that's indicative of warfare. You know, when we fought in World War II, we fought in two theaters of war. We fought the European theater with the Germans, and then we fought in the Japanese theater with Japan, or the Pacific Theater. And we're told that we're going to have the possibility of seven theaters of operation that exist within the realm of the satanic policy of evil, right? What are they? Tribulation, distress. What? We missed one. Persecution, famine, nakedness, peril, and sword. Those are the seven. And when I taught that, I told you that's a scope of what the adversary has available. And my understanding is when that policy of evil begins to work and go to work, it's going to do so in that order. So you can see right now, this is not talking about what you would suffer because of the sufferings of this present time, or what some Christians would suffer because they just stand up for Jesus, or they give the gospel to somebody, or even they're martyred because they're Christians and not Muslims. It seems like Islam is the only religion around that is killing people because they don't believe the way they do. But there you have it. And we have this particular step-by-step order of progression. And if you pay attention, I believe if you pay attention to Paul's life, you'll see that same progress of events. Well, this evening, if I could have you for a moment think of that a little bit as seven links of a chain that the adversary has. And if we put that on the board, we could put seven links up there, and the letters represent these letters down here: tribulation, distress, persecution, famine, nakedness, peril, sword. Just the P is duplicated up there. Well, my understanding is that is how the policy of evil is going to begin working. Now, I'm saying some things here without backing a lot of stuff up, and we'll get to that. But just to get it out on the table, that when it's almost like thinking of it as a link in a chain, once the tribulation, and each one of these, if we were to examine them, if my understanding's correct, and again, there's some things that may need adjustment. I know of one thing that I've adjusted already that's going to be rather interesting when we see it. And I told you there might be times of adjustment, but we'll get to that later. But there's in this progress, you know, when you're talking about tribulation, what are you talking about?
Trouble.
And in fact, you're probably not talking about it, like I say, in this first round with the adversary. I'd say I've come to appreciate, by the way, there's a couple of points in this list where the ante gets, to use a gambling expression, gets upped significantly. There's a couple of places in here, and that's pretty significant as well. But tribulation and distress, persecution, is where things get kind of ratcheted up. And then down here, when you get to peril and the sword, that's where it gets ratcheted up again as well. But if my understanding is correct, each one of these theaters of operation actually begins rather mild. It gets a little more intense, and finally, in its most intensive form, you actually begin seeing almost preview of the next thing on board, which would be for the tribulation, the distress that would come with that. And the links, if you use that terminology or that analogy, kind of have like this. They kind of have a range to them, where in tribulation it's going to start out very, very mild, and then some more moderate trouble, and then it gets rather intense, that is really kind of a precursor of the kind of distress that's going to take place. One thing about tribulation and distress, tribulation is oftentimes thought about, it is trouble, like we talked about before, but its most essential issue is something that causes you a problem, and it just can't be ignored. You're going to have to deal with it. And that's the kind of trouble that you start out with. But then that can get more advanced and more intensified to where it starts to cause you distress. And distress, as we've talked about before, is kind of more of the internal problems that begin to arise in the mind and that kind of thing, where you experience a real unsettling of the mind and a dismaying effect that takes place, and the source of that is the trouble that you're in. In other words, these link together. And we're not going to go in to explore all of that tonight or anything along those lines. I'm just trying to get the idea that there is some things going on. In fact, I think, as I say, that if we were to take these and kind of gray these from 3 to 7 here, really these two up here are the ones that are going to be the most concerning to us right now. Because nobody here is going to be going under the sword anytime soon. And I did not say that some one of you might get blown up by some bomb or something, but you're not going to go through the adversary's policy of evil of peril and sword against you because you are a far advanced son. We're not there yet. So he has no right to do that yet. So if a piano falls on you tomorrow, it wasn't Satan. It was a bad pulley or rope or the piano guy, but it wasn't Satan. All right. Now again, I would say, does that make sense? But I wouldn't be surprised if it didn't make a lot of sense right now. And it's just kind of information and getting some things out there that we'll come back to and we'll talk about. But when you come back here, let's come back now to this profile of the evil man. When you look at this here in Proverbs chapter 2, remember that a son is told before his education begins that he's going to face three enemies, three major enemies, three major opponents. And the father, this chapter 2 here would be like if you were in Romans 8:14 through 39. that's where all this chapter 1 and chapter 2 coincide as far as the exhortation. So you're talking about sonship orientation and sonship establishment. And what I'm saying is back there, and by the way, back there in sonship establishment in Romans chapter 8, you were told some things that you might have in the back of your mind, and I've mentioned them before. Well, how does the adversary know? How does he know what's going on? How does he know when I am putting on the armor of light and casting off the works of darkness? And I've talked about that, well, for one thing, when he usurped the heavenly... What were you told? One of the things you were told back there in the conclusion of Romans chapter 8 when Paul says, I am persuaded that neither... And he starts listing a whole bunch of things. One of the things he lists actually points to Satan's own central intelligence agency. Remember when he said, neither height nor depth? That is a reference, among other things, to the communication system that Satan got when he usurped the heavenly realm and when he usurped the earth. And it's not his communication system. God set that communication system up. God originally set up a communication system that had a height to it and it had a depth to it. The depth is in this earth, in the heart of the earth. And the biblical understanding of height and depth is that the earth is at the depth and God, the Heavenly Father, His throne in the third heaven is at the height. And there is a communication system that is in there. And that was genius on the part of the adversary. When he took possession of the heavenly realm and the earth, one of the very first things he knew was that this is going to be a fight. And I'm going to have to fight this God. I'm going to have to fight Jehovah God for this. It's going to be a contest. And one of the very first things any smart military person does when they take a piece of land or they begin a particular conquest is that they either cut or they get all of the communication system on their side. If you cut the communication system on the opposition, you've got a huge, huge benefit. Now, he didn't cut the opposition's use. God can utilize that same system as well, but the adversary uses it too. And all of his whole cohorts use it in connection with that. And I'm talking about there's information that is being passed throughout this whole thing, the creature from the earth to all in the heavenly realms by utilization of, as I've talked about before, how God created the firmament in the first place. And these are things that travel faster than the speed of light. Faster than the speed of light. In the blink of an eye, creatures light years, so to speak, from earth know what's going on. I know this from passages that Job has talked about, that there is a communication system and an intelligent network system. And by the way, there's going to come a point where the adversary loses half of it. When do you think that'll take place? Yeah, and when do you think, who's going to be up there instead? Us. He'll lose the height, but he'll still have the depths. And that's the reason why he knows what's going on with the remnant when they're on this earth. And don't underestimate the communication system and the depths either. But this is instant communication. Now you say, well, I just can't hardly believe that. Ask yourself why. Well, I was always told that nothing can go faster than the speed of light. By who? Scientists, do they believe the Bible? Most of them don't anymore. That's an example, by the way, and really, you can pin it right on, the relativity guy, Einstein. You know, we didn't think anything at one point. We thought that if you ever went faster than the speed of sound, you'd blow up. We found out you didn't blow up. You know, people thought Chuck Yeager was going to die when he was breaking the sound barrier. He didn't die. things get a little weird with air and the way it works and some things like that, but it worked. This idea that nothing can go faster than... I'll tell you one thing, angels go faster than the speed of light all the time. All the time. There's something far faster than the speed of light. The speed of thought, for one thing. And that's an example of where science has hindered man's knowledge, not advanced it. One of the great things or byproducts of modern science is how much it's hindered man's knowledge. Not expanded it, it's hindered it. Because you have preconceived set notions when God says something to you in the Bible where you say, well, that can't possibly be what he's talking about there. Because some book told me in my science class that those kinds of speeds and those kinds of things are just out of the realm of possibility, only to a scientist. And science will never catch up with the Bible, never. It'll always be way behind it, millennia behind it. Anyway, I didn't mean to get all off on that subject, but nevertheless, there it is. When it comes to looking at this section now, come back to the profile of the evil man. When it comes to looking at this section where your father tells you you're going to experience three major opponents to the success of your sonship education, flip back with me to chapter 1. I'm not going to read it. But beginning in verse 7, right after the table of contents, you've got the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom. I said I wasn't going to read it. You've got an exhortation to the son that immediately tells him, you're going to be your own worst enemy. The biggest, probably most hampering that you're ever going to have is from yourself. But then there's going to be the world at large, and there's some things, there's some terminology we're going to have to start getting more precise with. Because we've always said the evil man is the policy of evil, and the strange woman is the religious realm of Satan's policy. But really, they're both part of the policy of evil. So we've got to be a little bit more precise. Well, the next thing the father tells the son he's going to have to contend with is verse 10, my son, if sinners entice thee. Now he's got some just run-of-the-mill average sinners in the course of this world that you're going to be bumping up against, and you're going to have problems there. But it isn't until the son gets over here to having his commitment level really set firm, and now when he's exhorted to what he's going to get in his first round of education with the wisdom and the knowledge and all of these kinds of things, that's where verse 10 and down through verse 21 really kick in. The son now has his father set him down, and before the education begins, he tells him this third area that you're going to experience opposition and trouble and resistance from and problems with is going to be these two. This third realm has got two aspects to it, this evil man and this strange woman. And they are of a different class and category than just sin in general in the world or problems that you have from yourself. And so that's why the terminology is like it is in verse 10. And the very first word there is the word when. When means it ain't there yet. But when it does get there, when wisdom entereth into thine heart and knowledge is pleasant unto thy soul. So he's telling his son, when you go through wisdom and you start getting the benefit out of that wisdom and the kind of benefit that's going to come from that knowledge, when it's pleasant to your soul, and those of us in here who've gone through that together, this should describe you. You should be able to look yourself in the mirror and with all honesty say, wisdom has entered into my soul, wisdom has entered into my heart, and knowledge is now pleasant unto my soul. That describes me where I am at Romans 13, 13, 12, and 13. That describes me. Then he says, now notice what happens here. Notice the structure. I alluded to this before. A sentence begins in verse 10, right? It doesn't end until verse what? 17. And if you pay attention to the critical markings, you've got at the end of verse 10, you've got a semicolon, but you get a colon at the end of verse 11. So one of the things that tells me is that everything from verse 10 through actually verse the end of the chapter, but for especially verse down through verse 17, all of that is to be thought of together. Which means the evil man and the strange woman. And this is something I'm not sure that I taught either correctly or maybe wasn't as accurate as we need to be now, but we need to recognize something. At every single one of those links, at every one of these theaters of operation, even the very first go-round, the tribulation, you're going to experience trouble from both of those people, not just one. From the evil man and from the strange woman. And that will be the standard operating procedure throughout. That's the way it's going to work. That's the way God designed it to, or God allows it to work, and the way Satan designed it to work. So you have the son being told, and I'm harping on this because the context is so critical. When you're first told this, you don't know what in the world wisdom feels like, or what it's like to have wisdom enter into your heart, because you haven't got it yet. And you have no idea in the world what it means to have knowledge being pleasant unto your soul, because you haven't got it yet. You haven't experienced any of that yet. Your father told you that in advance. That's the same thing that happens in Romans chapter 8, and especially in verses 35, 36, 37, 38, and 39. Because your father tells you there, who shall separate you from the love of Christ? Shall tribulation, distress, persecution, famine, nakedness, peril, sword? Then he gives you the response for that and the remedy for that. But what I'm after is, you don't know what in the world it's like. We had to put ourselves, what did we do when we went through that probing question? We had to put ourselves in a virtual reality. We had to try to think, and that's fine, because that's all you can do. What it would be like to go all the way from trouble, tribulation, all the way to peril and the sword, where I might lose my life for this and feel that fear. But you hadn't actually done it yet. That's why it matches up with this perfectly. When this happens, then this is going to be the powerful result. Discretion shall preserve thee, understanding shall keep thee. And I'm not going to go back over the definition of those things. To deliver thee from the way of the evil man, from the man that speaketh froward things. Now, for the rest of the time tonight, I want to address an issue here where the first thing the father does when he tells the son, and again, put yourself back in the position you were a year, 2 years, or three, well, however many years it was ago, whenever we were back there in Romans chapter 8, and this was just theory at the time. Well, it's not theory now. Because when you determine that you are going to put on the armor of light, there ain't no theory about it anymore. This is now what's, and the armor that's going to keep you, the armor of light, the armor part of the armor, is discretion and understanding. And the discretion's going to preserve you. And just like with preservatives, where you, I don't even know how you'd make preservatives, but you put, I do know what it's like to open a jar of them, because I love strawberry preserves. When you open that jar, right? Air comes in. Air's been removed because the influence of air on that fruit is going to harm it and destroy it. And discretion is going to do that. It's going to provide for you to not be influenced. And that should tip you off. What am I to expect in this? What am I to expect in the first round of temptation? Yeah, that which is common to man. And this influence, And some of you might say, well, I said all the way back in Romans 12, 1 and 2 that I was going to live sober. I'm going to be sober-minded, and I'm not going to be conformed to this world anymore. And those kind of allurements and those kind of temptations, they just roll off my back. And for some of you, that's going to be about as tough as it's going to get. But it's going to come. For others of you, it may be a much tougher issue. I don't know. And I can't tell you. There's a big aspect of this that it's going to be put in your lap, and you're going to have to figure it out all on your own. You say, don't sweat it. Remember the three things we got. We got the exhortations here in Proverbs to give us some light into it. We've got the information sitting back in Romans 8 that gives us additional information about it. And we've got the actual curriculum that has produced the discretion and the understanding. So you're not underarmed. You're not overwhelmed. You're going to be able to meet this thing with absolute confidence that you're going to be more than a conqueror in it. But what I'm after tonight is to begin to develop this profile a little bit. And like I said, notice the colon at the end of verse 12, or pardon me, at the end of verse 11, rather. Now, normally a colon we talk about as being this very strong pause that we're to stop and think about everything before the colon, before moving on. But there's another aspect that a colon has, or another job that a colon has in the English language, and this is that other job. A list of things is now going to get given. Here the colon tells you, okay, what's coming up is a long quotation, and brother, is it. It goes all the way from, it started in verse 10, and it goes all the way, down through verse 17. And there's going to be an enumeration of some particulars. That colon sets you up for that. There's going to be, he says something at the start, then he puts a colon. At the start, he says, discretion shall preserve thee, understanding shall keep thee, colon. And now he's going to start enumerating some things. To deliver thee from the way of the evil man, and you get who's. And then you get the other one brought in. You get the strange woman. All right? So you're going to get an enumeration of some particulars. They're going to be given, some particular things are going to be enumerated by the Father for the Son that are going to form the mechanics. He's going to enumerate the mechanics of some evil men who are going to be utilized by the satanic policy of evil in order to attempt to oppose you, to resist you, and to put your light out as a sun. Prevent you from utilizing your armor successfully. And so what he says is, after that colon, he says, to deliver thee, verse 12, from the way of the evil man, from the man that speaketh froward things. Now, that's going to become the basic strategy of the evil man. And by the way, I may have changed up some of these terms from what you wrote down in notes. And as I showed you on Sunday, there's two of them. Two basic overall stratagems. Or two basic overall sides of his strategy. And that should not be surprising. There, the evil man is said here to, or evil men are said to have a way and speaking froward things. Now notice that it seems that there is, I want to point something else out that I maybe didn't point out quite as well before, but it seems that as you first read this, and probably this is where we need to start being more precise, that there is a singular evil man, right? Looks like. To deliver thee from the way of the evil man. And then he says, from the man that speaketh froward things. The problem is, as you go on down through the passage, it looks like what the writer does is shift from the singular to the plural. In fact, the who and the whos, are all second person plurals. Plus, in verse 15, you've got two plurals there. You've got they and there. T-H-E-I-R, they and their. So what's going on here? Well, what's going on here is the truth of the matter is there is no evil man. It's evil men from the get-go. It's always evil men. Look carefully at what this says. The more accurate way to think about the evil man, and this maybe is where the first place our thinking needs a little adjustment here, and I'm not apologizing for what we did, because that's the terminology that's used. It's just when you pay closer attention to it, you realize that it's not going to be the issue of an evil man. It's going to be the issue of evil men, plural. That's why when you get over to chapter 4 and the post-doctrinal exhortation is given in verse 14 to the receiving the instruction of godly judgment, enter not into the path of the wicked and go not into the way of evil men. It's also one of the reasons why the Apostle Paul, when he brings up the issue in the pastoral epistles as to how things are going to go in the dispensation of grace, evil men are going to wax worse and worse. Not the evil man, evil men. And the truth of the matter is, it was never to be really thought of as an evil man singular. If you pay careful attention to the way in which this is written and the way the English language presents this, it's really evil men from the get-go. Actually, verse 12 doesn't have just one man in view. He says, to deliver thee from the way of the evil man. That's one man. Comma. From the man that speaketh froward things. Another man. That's a second man. There are two men mentioned in verse 12. Not one, but two. That's why he's not shifting gears at all into the second person plural. He's already established a plurality in verse 12. Verse 12 is plural. There's evil men in verse 12, not just an evil man. There's evil men. And there's not one man in view. There's two separate men in view. The way of the evil man, that's one man. The man that speaketh froward things, that's another man. And so the son is supposed to perceive there are going to be two kinds of men that I'm going to have to deal with from the policy of evil. And they're going to be people. They are men. They're going to be real human beings. Not some kind of spooky, supernatural hobgoblin or demon. But these are real human beings that are going to oppose and resist you as a son. And you can kind of think of it this way. In confronting, when I confront the policy of evil and I make an actual gesture to the adversary that he can now begin to oppose me. And that's what you're doing when you're putting on the armor of light and you're intelligently knowing what you're doing. By the way, there is no way, I guarantee you, and I'll stand on this against any kind of withering opposition that may come, there is no way on this earth that a believer in Jesus Christ, no matter how sincere he was or she was, could, for instance, if their understanding of sanctification is back there in Romans chapter 6, and they're just getting some ideas of what it's like, to what it means to be dead to sin, alive unto God, and then they go to a Bible conference somewhere, and the Bible conference preacher or speaker is up there, and he's talking about Romans chapter 13, and that we should, as good Christians, we should put on the armor of light, we should cast off the works of darkness, and that's what you should be doing. And so come down in front and yield to somebody or Jesus or an usher or something, and then go out and cast off those works of darkness. That individual Christian, it is impossible for that Christian to do that. They are doing nothing when they go out and they say, "Well, I'm gonna cast off." They don't know what they are. They don't know they don't know that they fall into three general categories. They don't understand what the adversary is doing with those things. In other words, they don't understand the key to what the works of darkness are that makes them the works of darkness, which is dispensational timing, which comes from that saying that we get, the night is far spent, the day is at hand. Without understanding dispensational timing of this dispensation of grace, you might as well be quoting the Constitution, which will do you no effectual good. You might as well be quoting the Boy Scout manual, because you are not going to be casting anything off. You're not going to be provoking the adversary. You don't even come up on his radar screen. You don't. That communication, the CIA, Satan's own Central Intelligence Agency, reports nothing on that person, because they are taking a piece of the Bible and trying to use it when it's impossible for them to utilize it. This is the kind of aggravation I get with people who try to tell somebody how to be saved by turning from their sins and believe in Jesus. Folks, that's dangerous. That's not just simply, oh, well, it's just kind of, they just kind of muffed it up a little bit. No, they didn't. You can't be saved that way. You're still going to hell. I got some information that was sent to me just recently of a very popular evangelist who's going around. I got 2 free tickets. Like, I care. I didn't know what his gospel message was, so I checked it out from his own words, his own mouth. It's a little video on his own website. And he said that in order to be saved and know that you're going to heaven, you have to do several things here. And one of them is be led in prayer by him. You have to turn from your sins, repent of your sins. You have to invite Jesus into your heart. Did he give the death, burial, and resurrection? Yeah, but then he perverted it with things that you could not ask a person to do. No unbeliever can turn from their sins. They cannot. It's impossible. The power of sin has not been broken until after salvation. This isn't just sloppiness. This is malpractice. Spiritual malpractice. Well, sanctification has some of these same kind of elements in them. We need to get first things first, and it may be a real problem in this assembly. It may be a thing where we're going to have to look each other really hard. We're going to have to make some hard decisions when it comes to some newer people, how to bring them up and how to bring them along. Because how can you do this? You can't. I'm not trying to be mean about it. I'm just trying to say that that's the way this is designed to work. How in the world are you going to be able to do this without intelligently knowing what you're doing? It's impossible. The Spirit doesn't come along and say, "Aw, shucks, we'll just make it work." If that were the case, why, we'd all be completely, we'd be level 3 sons as soon as we were saved. He didn't do that. Well, one of the things, and we're about out of time here, but one of the things you need to realize is the accuracy of what you're being told, even though it's very general. Don't misunderstand generalness for inaccuracy. Starting out very general. In fact, Cecil could tell you, I'm assuming this, so he can correct me if I'm wrong, but one of the biggest things in the first round of, and I know this because I've talked to Kenneth, and Kenneth took some courses on forensics and this kind of thing. But the very first thing that one of the things that you are taught very strongly, whether it's from the FBI or all the way down to county sheriff, is that when you come onto a crime scene and you're going to begin to analyze a crime scene, don't underestimate the obvious. Look at the obvious. Does anybody know what what is it called? Occam's razor is? Ever heard of that expression, Occam's razor? Well, it was a scientist who came up with this principle. The razor is his principle, and it usually people always misquote it. They misquote it by saying the simplest explanation is the best. Occam's razor. The simplest explanation is the best. That wasn't all of Occam's razor. Occam's razor didn't just simply say the simplest explanation is the best. He said the simplest explanation that accounts for all the data is the best. It's got to account for all the data. And sometimes the most obvious things are the things that we overlook. And they're where you get into problems. And that's why we're coming back here, to see some obvious things, but see them with a little deeper understanding than we had when we were first told these things. Because now it's going to really become important. So you have a way. This evil man has a way, and another evil man, these evil men speak froward things. So the son is supposed to perceive there's going to be a couple of kind of people here I'm going to be dealing with. And you can kind of think of it as this, kind of in this way. As I'm confronting the policy of evil to begin with, first of all, I'm going to be dealing with evil men, plural. One in connection with a way. And that is going to be, as I said on Sunday, what is seen. Now, when we first went over those works of darkness, were any of those new to you? I don't know if there is a one on the list that was brand new that I'd never heard of that before. In fact, most of the things on those lists, in those three categories, you and I have had to deal with before. Right? So what's different about them now? What's different about them now is that the adversary can utilize those things as a part of his policy of evil against you. And what I'm trying to tell you is, there is not, it's not supposed to be like we've got to understand something that is beyond us of what this first round of trouble is going to be like. It's just now coming at you, you've just never had it presented to you by the adversary before. And when I say by him, I don't mean by him personally. But in connection with the evil men, I'm going to see one of these evil men in connection with what is seen. He has a way. And there's going to be another in connection with speaking and what is heard. And the methodology of the evil man in its basic form is in connection with these two main methods. That's going to be his two main methods. That's his basic strategy. Strategy is the overall battle plan. It's the big picture. He's going to use what is seen, what is heard. He's going to use a particular way, and that is going to be observable and something you can see, and it enters in through the eye gate. And he's going to utilize men who say certain things, and by saying those things, there's information that's going to influence you, that's going to enter into the ear gate. And as I said, those are the two primary ways of all the five senses. Those are the two primary ways in which an individual can be influenced by others. What he sees them do and what he hears them say. And one of those evil men is going to be a specialist in the realm of the visual. And the other evil man is going to be a specialist in the realm of the audible. What is seen and what is heard. And once verse 12 describes the general basic overall tactics of the evil men, then you get verses 13, 14, and 15 come along, and we're going to start looking at those on Sunday. And you've got basically the basic visual audio tactics. The who's. And there's going to be six of them. One of them is who leave the paths of uprightness, who walk in the ways of darkness, who rejoice to do evil, and delight in the frowardness of the wicked, whose ways are crooked, and they froward in their paths. And then we get another colon. And even though we could put a period there, the strange woman is supposed to be, that thought about the strange woman is supposed to be connected with the evil man. And it's very clear there's only one of her. When you look at the personal pronouns, it's her, 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 her. It's not they. So you get these. Now that's what I'm calling it right now. Now tactics are the implementing of the strategy on the battlefield, right? I'm going to say something here. I don't know if it's going to click or not, but I thought. How am I going to express this, or how am I going to put this for you? And that's what you get here. That, by the way, this is one of the reasons why I use audio, my voice, and video. Audio, video. That's why in any kind of Steve Jobs, I don't care if you're a billionaire, all the way down to, you know, somebody doing Avon, when they're going to make a demonstration of it, or they're going to talk, they use both realms, audio, video. That's why PowerPoint is such a big deal. That's why back in the days before PowerPoint, a teacher didn't just stand up and teach, but behind her she had a great big blackboard. And she would both teach you with audio and video, visual and audio. And this is something the adversary knows, he's very good at, and he realizes how powerful this thing is. And verses 13, 14, and 15 are going to go into enough detail. Now, let me back up and say what I was prefacing all of that to say. I use the word tactics up there. And I think we'll end on this because I'm out of time. But look, there's a difference between... And I'm not saying this to try to... I'm not trying to say that I understand combat. I've never been in combat. But I've been around enough men in combat and had them explain to me what happens to know that from that I glean that you have a higher echelon of officers, your general officers, they come up with a strategy. Then that strategy is given to a lower echelon of officers, your majors, your captains, your first and second lieutenants, and they're going to take it and put it into effect tactically. And so they've got a section of the battlefield and they're going to fight in that section of the battlefield. But there's another level to this. And I listen to this carefully. The other level to this is that it gets given to the sergeants of the squads and the privates who are going to be in the squads to actually carry some of these things out. They may have no idea what the strategy is, but they know what they're supposed to do, and even then, they're going to have to figure some things out on their own. This is why battle is called a fluid thing. It's always fluid. The very first thing you throw out in any battle is the rule book, because it seems like the rules go out the window. Now, the reason I'm telling you this, and this is very important for you to get this, the way this is going to work, even though I use the word tactics on the board up there, there are such things as personal tactics. It's one thing to be a part of a, and I know some of you have no frame of reference for what I'm about to say, and I'm sorry for that, but it's one thing to be a part of a platoon. Platoons are what, 30, 34 men, something like that? Within that platoon, there are squads made up of just a few men. Well, the platoon is inserted into the battle, and the platoon is supposed to be doing something, hold ground, take ground, or whatever they're supposed to be doing. But your individual squads are out there performing the work of the whole platoon. So what I'm saying is when it gets down to the individual soldier, he has to make some decisions. Can I go this way, or do I need to go around? The tactics don't tell you the details of how he might flank you. And what I'm telling you in all of this, what your father did here was absolute genius. What he's given you are some particular basic tactics that he could write in his book, and he could send that book through time, knowing that any time his son picked that book up, or daughter, at any time period of human history, under any circumstances that son or daughter would find themselves, under any kind of national entity, in any kind of culture, with any kind, I mean everything from high sophisticated culture down to tribal living, wherever my son, if I was the father, wherever my son picked up my book and learned these tactics, they would have enough information based upon the other things they're bringing with them in the curriculum from Romans 8. They're going to have enough information to be able to sit there and determine in all of the details of their life, which I don't know. You do. Only you do. Not me. I don't live your life. But you're going to have enough information to be able to figure out on your own that evil man and that strange woman and be able to detect them, to be able to know exactly what to expect from them, and to have the defenses of the discretion and the understanding that will preserve and keep. That's the that made it so that God didn't have to write a Bible that was 10 trillion volumes long, where every single scenario of your possible would be written about. He doesn't have to do that. He can give you this basic information. When you combine that with the discretion and the understanding, then you're going to have clarity into this battle and into who you're facing as an enemy and who you're going to be dealing with and how they're going to be approaching and what their tactics are, and you're off to the races. You're not just simply set adrift. But I'm telling you that there is a point where I can't tell you what's going to take place or how you're going to deal with it. You're going to have to figure it out on your own. And that, when I say on your own, let me make this caveat. Between you and your Heavenly Father, you're going to deal with it. That's a new aspect for some of you of sonship prayer you may not have entered into yet. And you're going to find you've got a whole bunch more to talk to your Heavenly Father about now that this battle's underway. And so you start ratcheting up your sonship prayer life, your communion fellowship with your Heavenly Father. All right, well, I'm going to stop. I'm over time again. I thought I might go 35, 40 minutes tonight. Shoot. There's just so much. Any questions? I see some people who've got maybe a question. Any questions? Or don't you want to ask them right now? You want to get out of here. It's raining outside, so. Does that much kind of seem plausible? I'm not asking you that it's, everything is sound right now, because we've got a ways to go yet. As sons?
Some of them are. They study their Bible, they are in it, and they would die.
Well, I'm not saying there's not.
They would kill them because they're Christian, but they would choose to die rather than say, let's say, yes, okay, I am a Muslim, or yes, we will convert, or something like this. There are people who
I don't doubt that. I'm sure there are.
That's where I don't understand why it's different. You had that conversation on Wednesday or Sunday, but I couldn't hear what was going on. So what is the difference?
Well, I think the difference is just what you said it was. It's the difference. The difference.
Mm-hmm. But you have other people who are examples, and that would lead masses or Bible studies or so on, and they want to make an example of them. They would come and they would put them to death. So,
okay, and I'm not doubting that there's places in this world where they rightly...
The Christians of the Middle East, some of them just happen to be born Christian. So
right. Right.
They usually torture them or keep them, mm-hmm. So they would be a constant reminder for the rest of the population.
Yeah. The Spanish Inquisitions did some similar things. But what I'm after, though, is I'm not going to try to pretend that I've got the corner on any of this. What I'm saying is I fully believe that there are churches out there and there's Christians out there who have taken their Bible and they have seen God's word rightly divided. They understand it rightly divided. They understand what's going on today. They see Paul's epistles as the curriculum, as the as not just meat to or milk to meat, but they see this as the way in which godly edifying is to take place, and that they are being edified, and therefore they come under. We're not blazing a trail here that's never been trod. I understand that. But what I think you've got to do is you've got to be able to say with, you've already acknowledged by what you just said that you see at least, now there, I don't know if you see more, but at least you mentioned two ways in which a Christian could lose their life. At least two.
Yeah.
One, they're just called a Christian and they don't like it. And so, and then, okay. So if you see a plurality of ways, what I'm saying is, even within that, there's more than two. There could be 10 or 15 reasons why Christians get persecuted. What I'm saying is, what the adversary is doing, I think it comes down to asking yourself this, how does that, and sometimes the sword is not the biggest problem. It's getting to the sword. How does that truly separate? And again, I don't think this is probably the healthiest thing to go down and talk about, but the question I would ask is, how does that separate me from the love of Christ? You see what I'm saying? In other words, in somebody who's just a Christian and they don't like him, so they're going to off their head, that didn't separate them from the love of Christ. The persecution, let's say they didn't kill him, the persecution didn't separate them from the love of Christ. See what I'm saying? I'm saying that the persecution that in the overall ways in which Christians get hated on, despised, and within that whole realm, and I'm not discounting that's part of the policy of evil. It has to be. It's part of the darkness of the world in which we live. I don't have a problem with that. But what I'm saying is that within all of that, there is a segment of the policy of evil that is specifically designed to separate an intelligent son from the love of Christ. So you cannot do that unless the love of Christ has been generated within them. And if I follow what you're saying is, you're saying there are those who that's happened, then I don't have a problem at all with that. But if it hasn't, it's not this, it's something else. Yeah. That's what I'm wanting to be careful with.
They keep them as an
example. But they could do that with somebody who just really loves God and the Bible and has not gone through this curriculum at all. They could do that too. They could make an example out of any Christian, couldn't they?
Sure.
But there are, and I perfectly consent that there's some that they make an example out of that may be sons who that whole example is trying to separate them from the love of Christ. That's why that proves what I just was doing in the last 15 minutes of Bible class, that it has to come down to you being able to determine on your own how this is going, because only you know really how well all this information is working and be able to utilize it and with sonship prayer be able to make some decisions along those lines. That's why I'm...
That's Romans 8, where that comes in.
That's where it begins, yeah.
Sorry, I asked the question, but because I was...
No, I'm... Oh, I know. Yeah, I don't repeat that. Yeah, I know.
But I couldn't hear anyone.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you.
Anybody got anything else to add? It's a big subject. You want to teach it? Yeah, we're going to flesh this out, and it's going to be good because we're going to know what we're doing. We're not going to be put into battle, not here, not in this, not under my watch. You're not going to be put in without knowing what you're doing. That gets people killed. And I don't mean physically killed in this instant, but okay. We'll stop right there. And it just doesn't sound like the rain's letting up at all, so I guess you're going to...